My name is Tricia Paik. Welcome to this talk on Georges Seurat drawings. I wanted to know how many of you have actually seen the show yet? A quarter of you or so, and so the rest of you are in for a great treat after you hear our talk today. The show, Georges Seurat, the drawings, was curated by Jody Hauptman. She's a curator here in our drawings department. And it's a great pleasure for me to talk about the show today because I was on the team as well to help coordinate, curate, and organize this exhibition. It was a team of four individuals, Jody Hauptman, myself, Carl Buckberg, who is a senior conservator in our Department of Conservation here, who did extensive conservation research and were able to introduce that to you today in our exhibition, and I'll briefly touch upon it in our talk today, and as well, Varenne Tessot, who we imported from France, who helped us with all things French and research. So we had a wonderful team to work on this show. We worked on it for about 2 years, off and on a few years prior to that. And it was an extraordinary exhibition to work on for many reasons. The significance of these drawings, as you'll see, are so important for his own work, as well as for late 19th century French painting and art, as well as how it leads us into the 20th century, into modes of abstraction, and as well just for the sheer beauty of these drawings, as you'll probably attest to after you see the exhibition. And as well, this exhibition is the first drawings exhibition since, you know, in almost 25 years. So to be able to gather all these works for you, albeit for a limited time, was an extraordinary feat. And a lot of people have asked why the show is not traveling. It would have been amazing to have done that for an international public. However, if it was traveling, many of the lenders would not have lent their works to our show because of the fragility of light exposure. So hopefully many of you will come back to see it more than once or twice because you'll never have this opportunity in a long time. So we'll see what happens over the next 25 years, who might take on the next challenge to bring together the Seurat drawings. So I hate the height of this. Let me just... I always have a fight with this thing. It limits my motion, and I like to move. Okay. Well, any of you might know that Seurat actually died a very young death at age 31. And at least for me, it makes me question my productivity. He was extraordinarily prolific. He had made his name when he was 26 for the painting that you probably all know quite well, Sunday on la Grande Jatte, which was exhibited in 1886 in Paris at the 8th and last Impressionist exhibition, which was an important moment because it basically ended Impressionism as we know it, whereby artists such as Manet and Degas, Renoir, would depict their vision of the world using a very light, loose brush stroke. And instead, with Seurat's great masterpiece here, which literally sealed his fate of being such a key figure of the late 19th century French painting, into a kind of brush stroke that's very tight, controlled, a bit of science behind it. He developed his own kind of color theory, where he would talk about what he would call his mélange optique, basically optical mixture, by which he intended the mixture of the colors, the contrast and complementary colors applied adjacent to each other, would then be mixed literally in the eye of the beholder, and not necessarily, of course, through the palette. And so that was his great contribution. And some have debated his technique. You know, a lot of people, after seeing the show, they say that they love his drawings much more than his paintings, that his technique in some ways was a little bit limited after a while, but that can be a debate that I leave for you to debate amongst yourselves or between yourselves or whatever. But in any event, he was extraordinarily prolific. By the time he died, he had painted about over 200 paintings. That includes his great masterpieces, which I'll quickly show you, as well as 500 drawings. So you might also be familiar with bathing place, Anier, which is in the National Gallery in London. And that's from 1884. So prior to Grand Jatte. The Models, or Models, which is at the Barnes Foundation from 1886 to 1888. Circus Sideshow, which many of you New Yorkers should be familiar with. Is that the Met? Can people hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Just keep, raise your hand, scream out Trisha if you can, because I kind of might trail back into my regular speaking voice. Yes, okay, thank you. So here's Circus Sideshow at the Met. And Chaout, which is at the Kroller Muller in the Netherlands from, let's see, 1889 to 90. And then his last work here, Circus, which is at the Orsay in Paris, which he died, which he painted in his last year of his death, so it's unfinished. And I don't know if any of you noticed that this is the only work, only major painting of his that's in France. And as a very important scholar, Françoise Cachin, wrote for the great retrospective of Seurat at the Met and in Paris almost 15 years ago, she wrote about the great delay of the French public to appreciate Seurat's drawings and paintings. And I think we can all be proud Americans that a number of the great masterpieces are here in American collections. And I probably you all know that the Grand Jatte belongs to the Art Institute in Chicago. And so Cachin talks about how, you know, probably most likely because of his early death, he was unappreciated. But by the 1900, many of the great paintings and canvases and sketches and drawings had left France. And coincidentally, the painting here that's now at Orsay was actually bequeathed back to France in 1924 by an American collector. So, you know, France had let that go, and France did not make any public acquisitions of Seurat until 1947, first handful of works that are in the Orsay. So everyone outside of France seemed to grab onto his importance, but luckily the French finally caught up a century later. So another aspect of his work, just quickly I wanted to show you, are his seascapes, for which he's also known. But of course, he is best known for his Grand Jatte and his dots, so much so that in 1986, a century after he debuted that work, you know what happened, maybe, theater lovers out there, Sunday the Park with George, Stephen Sondheim's rendition of this with Manny Patinkin and Bernadette Peters. Anyone saw it? Anyone out there? I only seen video of it. And just a little fun aside, an image where you see Manny Patinkin as George and Bernadette Peters as a bustled woman there at the right. And you can all recognize the composition of that canvas. So even though he is so tied, you know, Seurat in our popular imagination, to the Grand Jatte and to his famous dots, you know, when I would be telling friends that I was working on the show, they'd be like, oh yeah, the dot guy. But we were hoping to free him of the definition of the dot guy in this exhibition, which I'm hoping you will see, because his drawings are tremendous and are not made of dots, although some have argued that you can kind of make out a bit of the dot in his application of the Conte medium onto his preferred paper, which I'll talk about as we go along, which had this highly texturized surface so that you would see these kind of dots that come out. But some have argued that there is a connection, but I think it's too iffy to say that he got the dots from his drawing practice. But as I said, drawing... he created 500 drawings throughout his life. About 270 are from his maturity, and we've been able to gather half of those. We can proudly say we have 119 drawings in this exhibition, 4 canvases, 10 oil on panels, 4 extant sketchbooks, all the sketchbooks that remain, extant remaining sketchbooks of Seurat, and then 1 letter. And a little bit of a side, just kind of a bit of a numbers. You can't hear me. Okay, I'll speak louder. Thank you. Another exciting thing is that 69 of the works here in our exhibition are from private collections. And so that's literally half of our exhibition, and the rest are from public institutions. So this is a rare opportunity to see many works that haven't been seen in a very long time. And for example, one work we've been trying to track down for 2 years finally uncovered itself a few weeks before the exhibition, so we were able to add that work. So, you know, the ability to curate an exhibition is always changing as we uncover new finds. Anyway, so I wanted to here impress to you today the importance for drawing for his practice. And while he did a number of studies that relate to his great canvases, which he called canvases of combat, a term that he chose literally to show that he was doing his best to challenge the pre-existing conditions of painting and aesthetics. So even though he created these studies, he also viewed his drawings as finished works of art. And surprisingly, he exhibited more drawings during his lifetime than paintings, which I think really establishes how central he viewed drawing. As well, as you go through the exhibition, you can see that the majority of the drawings that we have on view are what we call floated. So you can see the edges of the drawing paper, of the support, instead of being over-matted by a mount or a mat. And you can see he drew literally to the edges. Here is not the best example because these are cut images, but you can see that he drew literally to the edges of the support, which show that he viewed them as finished objects. Another interesting quote I want to share with you before I move on is by his fellow artist friend named Armand Jean, of whom he would draw an extraordinary portrait that's in the Met collection and which we have in our exhibition. And his friend said, quote, "It is drawing, thoroughly understood, that puts Seurat on the right path," unquote. And so before we lose any more time, we'll move on to this right path. And just another work that I wanted to show you here. Oh, this is an extraordinary work, also in a private collection that hasn't been seen in many years. And this is from the Orsay in Paris. So here we have very little archival evidence of Seurat. We have this one photograph, undated. He was known for his a reserved nature. One of his friends called him, Degas called him the notary. And he once also acknowledged about himself, he said, "I do not speak a great deal, but it is obvious that through his art he was the most eloquent through his use of color, his so-called dots, and then more significantly for our case today in black and white and how he depicted his vision of the world using the most minimal of means, literally just a black medium, which I'll talk about, on paper, and what he was able to achieve and how he was able to create this intense luminosity just from using white and black. Just a brief bio. He was born in Paris in 1859 into a bourgeois family. His father was a bailiff, and he was quite smart, and he was very successful in real estate speculation. So Seurat he could just devote himself entirely to drawing and to his art, unlike, you know, Van Gogh, and who died, unfortunately, very penniless. So Seurat starts drawing at age 15, starts getting academic training by 17, and then draws these wonderful studies after antique cast, which you can see on the left, and then after the nude, which you see here on the right. These were drawn when he was age 18 at the École des Beaux-Arts. And just a little interesting aside, because I think this is a great opportunity to share some inside stories. We invited four outside scholars to contribute to our catalog, and a little shameless plug to go out and by our catalog. There's a great introduction and essay by Jody Hauptmann, an essay on technique and conservation by Carl Buckberg, who is part of our team, and then four guest scholars contributed, Hubert Damiche from France, Richard Schiff, who some of you may be familiar with if you read art history books, Richard Thompson, and then Bridget Riley, the artist. And Bridget Riley wrote a very important text at the time of the Met and Paris shows in the early 90s about how Seurat's paintings literally pushed her off into the world of color, and how the drawings also were so significant for her work. And it was a great honor to work with her over the past few years, and we took her around the exhibition during the installation. And she's so eloquent and incredibly intelligent, and we paused in front of this comparison, which we have upstairs, and she said to me that it's interesting how he was inspired by both the nude as well as by the antique. And of course, that was part of the academic training at the École des Beaux-Arts, is to draw in front of the antique sculpture. But she said that even though your goal at the time as a student is to literally depict realistically what the artist would see, whether in the nude or whether in the cast, is that, of course, the antique sculpture is an idealized form of the body, right? And then you have here a realist, more real version of what someone looks like, and here something even more realistic of this aged man nearing the end of his life. And Bridget said to me, I'm sure that he found great inspiration from the antique casts, because so much of what Seurat was about was trying to give you this idealized version of the world, something very stable and still, and not about giving you the kind of muck of everyday Parisian life. He idealized these figures like the rag picker, which we'll see in the next few minutes. So just wanted to share that little side from Bridget Riley, because I think it's a really wonderful observation about what he got from these different modes of training that was being offered at the École des Beaux-Arts at that time, which Bridget then told me was not was being cast aside, literally, when she was in training in London, because at the time, after post-war, it was all about getting rid of the old. And so the cast room for her in her studies were the places where you didn't go. So she was saying it's unfortunate that artists are no longer learning to draw from the cast and what that offered herself as well as Seurat. And here we have two images of two of the sketchbooks that we've gathered for you in the exhibition upstairs. We know of at least these four, and then another breath sketchbook, sketches that he drew during his military service in Brest in northwestern France. And so these were drawn from about 1877 to 1881. And you'll have a great treat when you go upstairs, because what we've been able to do is use technology to its fullest, and we've digitized every page in each of these sketchbooks. You can literally leaf through it and see what Seurat was thinking about, what he was drawing, what was the central focus of his attention as he was out in the streets, on park benches, in Parisian gardens, at cafes. So hopefully you'll have a chance to look at that as well. Here is a fun little comparison. Again, it's amazing what technology can do. If any of you took art history classes in high school, college, grad school, you know that you're always stuck with that comparison, right? One and two. And now with PowerPoint presentations, I can offer you three. And so here we have a kind of transition from the earliest example on the left for you. But again, I don't know why we've got this double vision of two screens. So we've got circa 1880 to 81 on the left, and then the middle, also from about the same year, and then this last work from 1881 to 82. So you can see here how he's working just in black and white. He is using this hatching technique, which was one that was taught, I think, in schools, and how he's not using the line in a different way to build up massing of darker areas and lighter areas. And here you have line as contour, still some line here as contour, and still here as well. But soon he's going to free line, this linear treatment, as an outline around the body, and instead using line in a very different way, which I'll show you. But here I just wanted to show you this transition of what's happening in his work in the early 1880s to the heart of his great drawings from the early to mid-80s. And we step here to 1882 with this, I think, an extraordinary example. And this comparison we have for you upstairs. This is in a private collection, and this is in the British Museum in London. And here you have now a different treatment of line. Line no longer to indicate the form of the body. It's just a massing of forms, the use of his preferred medium of Conte crayon. And instead, line is being used not longer as description, but as to try and indicate to you this sense of the fields and of this kind of shadowy, ambiguous space in which this lady is now standing. And his use of the horizon line, too, is one that is unusual, and that is not you know, defaulting to Albertian perspective. Instead, the horizon line is all the way up, and it's a little bit hard to tell as a viewer where indeed this man is existing, this gleaner is existing within the wheat fields, as well as this figure. So it's this great ambiguity through his use of black and white and his abandoning of Albertian perspective that I think gives Seurat's great power to his works. And here we get to his truly mature style, whereby pretty much line is abandoned. It's pretty much gone. You can see a little bit in areas of the application, but now what he's done is created, using the Conte medium, which is what our conservator calls carbon black and clay combined at a very high temperature. And it's very densely packed. It's not like charcoal or pastel, but it has that kind of density, a little bit powdery, but Carl Buckberg said, no, it's not really powdery either. But what he discovered is that it needs to be fixed. So if any of you who have drawn or taken some classes before, he would have to apply a layer of fixative or something in order to hold the pigment in place. Because if he didn't fix it, then you'd get a kind of wash of Conte medium just kind of literally falling out from the sheet of paper. So he would have to fix different layers in order to get this kind of effect. And when we visited Yale University Art Gallery to look at their drawings there and to look at the sketchbooks, who've lent us two of the sketchbooks as anonymous lender to Yale. One of the curators told us that students from their Yale MFA program came to the gallery with Conte crayon, with texturized paper that, you know, for some modern-day versions of it, to try and imitate how Seurat drew. And all these talented young artists in training found it extraordinarily, excruciatingly difficult to copy his technique because it took a level of control, the layering of the application, as you'll see when you go upstairs. I mean, these images do not do it service at all. So hopefully you can go up close. And another tip that we found when we looked at these drawings is that when you go up close, you lose a detail of the forms. And when you look at them from a distance, please play that game and look at it from a distance, see what you see, and then go up close. And you'll find that the further you're away, the more you see. And the closer you go up, the whole composition starts to fall apart. For example, there's one drawing where I never knew there was a face just the other day. And I never saw it because I was always looking so closely or even looking at bad reproductions. And then the further I stepped away, I finally saw this face emerge. So hopefully you'll be able to do that when you go upstairs. And here's his great masterpiece that I was telling you about at the Met Collection, collected by the great Stephen Clark, the two brothers who you may be aware of, who were celebrated at a recent show at the Met. This was drawn in 1883 of his friend Armand Jean, the gentleman who I told you who said that drawing put Seurat on the right path. And here you see, an element of this of one of his great ideas and techniques that he would expand upon is what he calls this irradiation, basically where you apply a contrasting areas of color. So this black, dark black head against this lighter area in order to show the figure in its full power, which you see even more with these drawings, these from the same time, about circa 1883. And you see this more clearly, what he called irradiation. So you have this halo effect surrounding the figure, and you have this highly contrasted areas of white in contrast to the darker black. And if you look carefully when you go upstairs, you can see how he's had to apply his conte in this very controlled way. We learned that he was able to erase conte to get areas of white. But what's amazing when you look at this drawing here, this the body or the mass of this luscious hat that you see here on this lady is created by the white of the paper. So when you look at these drawings, you can see what he's able to accomplish by applying just a little bit of conte on top and then the conte surrounding it to give you the sense of her bun and hair and then her face and neck, and then to give the substance of the hat, and then this little collar, might have been a fur collar, but probably not, just like a white collar. And this little game, anyone recognize this drawing? Here we have the painting of the landscape, which I think it was it Roberta Smith who said it was like a stage set, or was another reviewer who said it's kind of like the stage set before all the players and actors start entering the scene. And anyone might remember where she stands? To the right? To the left here. Just kind of a fun little game that I like to play. And you can go upstairs. We have a reproduction of this, and you can see the studies and see where he placed them and what decisions he made. He cut out a number of figures in some of the studies that we have and how he's able to construct this canvas. So, again, there's so much one can talk about. I'm not going into the grand jet because I really want to focus on the drawings. Here you have another subset of his work where he is exploring the industrialization of Paris and the outskirts of Paris. Jody Houtman wrote an amazing essay about this idea of the suburbs, which, of course, is truly a late 19th century modern invention because it was a train, right, that allowed us to go to the suburbs. And already the Impressionists took up on this topic, showing figures at leisure, on the water or in gardens. But Seurat did not explore that. As I said, he was interested in the muck of Paris, which he would then kind of get rid of. So you have this beautiful scene of this train departing, as well as the encroaching electrical poles along railway tracks. And he's able to render it, again, this kind of idealized way, making this clouds of smoke, which, you know, we talk about today with global warming and ozone layer, into a beautiful puff of smoke. Little do we know then what it would do to our Earth. But here it's something that's not about dirt and grime, but something that's idealized and quite beautiful. And again, this kind of stillness that I wanted to address, this idealization. Here we have this rag picker who is the lowest of the low, and literally he would be walking around Paris and the suburbs, you know, picking up whatever he could in this little basket here. And then you have this a wonderful drawing. And these are both from about 1882 to 1883. Here, this house. And here I wanted to show you the paper. And I'm hoping those of you in the back can see it as those of you in the front. I was told by a colleague in my last talk that it wasn't visible. But what I was talking about, Seurat's choice of a texturized paper produced by a company named Michelet. And in many of the drawings, you can see the watermark Michelet, where these wider space lines are what you call chain lines. And I'm sure many of you know this paper that you use today, laid paper. Anyone familiar with this? I've used it for resumes in the years past, where you have this kind of grid, this larger chain lines, and then these thinner lines, thinly spaced lines called laid lines. The chain lines and the laid lines. So it gave him this kind of pre-existing grid, which he opted to choose and use throughout his 11-year career. He liked that texturized surface, and what Carl Buckberg discovered was that he played around with this surface, and I just want to quickly show you just something so you can understand it better. Here's the laid paper mold. This is a modern 20th century version. So you can see here the wet paper pulp would be applied onto the top. These, I don't know the terminology, I'm not a conservator, you have these wires, these thicker wires, which would then create the chain lines, and then these thinner rods would give you the laid lines that I was talking about. So when you go back and you look at this surface, you can kind of see how he was able to manipulate and use that grid and even kind of relish the imperfections that come out of the handmade paper making process. Here you can see the lines too along the surface. And in the bag of the rag picker, do you see a little bit of this white area smudged out of the bag? He did that by using these paper stumps, which are rolled pieces of paper, which allow the artist to remove material, remove the medium. So he would do stumping, and this is a turn of the century Conte crayon and modern crayons. So he would literally take that stump and remove medium or smush it even more, fix it, then layer another layer of application of the Conte crayon. And here, what allows a kind of luminescence of the drawings, the white that I was talking about, is where the Conte crayon does not fall into the grooves of the laid paper. So here is the higher surface of the paper, and here is the paper, and this is a photomicrograph of one of Seurat's drawings. So you can see how, if we go further back, like in here, these little white areas where the paper does not pick up the medium, that's what you see here. Is that clear? Mm-hmm. So one of our critics also critiqued us for having too much discussion about conservation and techniques in our exhibition, in our catalog and exhibition, but we feel that how we made it is central to how we can understand his work. So this is why we spent so much attention to his focus on the texture. And we made a connection as well to his wood panels. We have a series of 10 studies of his on wood panels, which were commercially produced panels of about this size. And you can see in a number of the panels we have upstairs, and it's hard to make in these images, there are these kind of striations across the surface of the panel that kind of interlock with the actual natural grain of the wood panel. And he chose not to gesso it. He only primed it using glue. So you have the natural wood color, which he really took pleasure in using as a basis for sky or for sand or for water. So you can see this kind of overall brown color. And a lot of artists would choose gesso, white gesso, to color and get rid of that. But instead, he liked to have the brown. So interlocking with the natural grain of the wood, we saw in these images these kind of striations that go up and down. And in the beginning, we had our object conservator here at MoMA, who's a wood specialist, look at these images, first of all, because we didn't have them here. And he thought that these striations came from the commercial making planing process of the wood. So we had this idea in our head. We wrote about it in object labels and such. And then when we finally got the works here, we got our object conservator to come look at these panels, a few that we had. And he said, oh no, that was Seurat. He actually scored using an implement to create this texture. So he's carrying the kind of methodology of the gridded, texturized Michelet paper into his use of the wood grain. And I brought you, again, a photomicrograph that our conservator took, where you see this kind of scoring of the wood and then how the oil paint literally skips over that texture, right? It looks very similar to what I showed you before with his use of Conte crayon on the paper. And one last aspect I wanted to introduce to you again about this conservation idea. This is a work in our collection, Evening Grand Comp. He was, as I said, he did a series of important seascapes. And in this painting, Richard Schiff, who was one of our guest authors, asked us to study this painting because this is a bad image, but you can see upstairs there's a similar kind of striation that you find on the surface of the canvas. And we noticed that this striation did not coincide. It wasn't, it didn't coincide with the actual weave of the unprimed canvas. So what we did was we x-rayed it and discovered that what he had done was he had taken gesso and he had used a comb or a brush, another kind of implement, to texturize the gesso. A lot of artists would choose to kind of apply it smoothly. Some artists did also texturize it, so this is not a new thing. Artists are known to have done this back then. But he chose to do this throughout the canvas, and you can see these kind of striations. Again, this focus on the support. And so what Jody Hauptmann and Carl Buckberg argue is that his paper, his use of canvas, his use of the oil panel of the wood is not really, should not be really viewed as a support per se, but it really is also his medium. It's a combination of those two that are truly his medium, and he was able to create so many types of effects with, you know, with just especially with his drawings, with the barest of means. And I wanted to close with the last series of important works he created at the end of his life, the Café Concert, which many of you might be familiar with from paintings by Manet and Degas and posters by Toulouse-Lautrec. These were these fantastic specialized cafes in Paris that by 1850s, 1860s were transformed from the regular cafe into a cafe of performances where you would have singers and acrobats, other kind of performers performing kind of lowbrow songs to operettas by Offenbach. And so in these places where Seurat again would frequent, he would depict, here's our drawing, which we're very proud to have, given to us by one of our founders, Lily P. Bliss. Here we have one of the Café Concerts, the Concert Européen. And here you have two other examples, one from RISD, one from Cleveland, also specific places where, again, he idealizes these forms into just wonderfully abstract shapes in many ways. Again, if you go up close, this composition falls apart. This one has more detail for you to see. His focus on outlines of these bowler-hatted men, these, you know, other, the ones prior to that, these kind of bonneted figures. And we've gathered for you almost all of the ones that that still exist for you upstairs, so hopefully you can look at those. And his one foray into a kind of a printmaking process, he did this near the end of his life, which you can look at as well. And we kind of guessed that, you know, if he didn't die at age 31, he might have been able to go into printmaking truly investigate that technique, but he died at 31, so one never knows what he might have done. And I just wanted to give you a little another shameless plug for another Seurat event that we are preparing for the public. Since the Café Concert was so important for Seurat, as well as for his Impressionist predecessors, we wanted to give the public a feel of what it was like to actually listen to the music we've seen all the images over the period of, you know, using Manet and Degas, Toulouse-Lautrec, and Seurat's great drawings. But what did the public hear at this time? So we've invited a very talented theater group called The Civilians, who right now have a Broadway run down at Barrow Street Theater. I recommend you highly going to see them. But they've been inspired as well by the Café Concert of Paris, and they had this show that they've been workshopping. So we invited them to perform a number of the original songs, which are rarely performed today. And we're going to gather, we've gathered readings of the time, as well as images created at the time, posters, and to give you the feel of what it was like for Seurat to be in the audience and drinking his beer and listening to the performers and being inspired to draw the drawings that we have for you upstairs. So I wanted to end here. You can go online and look at what else we can offer you. We have an online exhibition. If you just go to www.moma.org, you can find our online exhibition, which gives you more information about what I shared with you today, about conservation, his interest in subject matter, and as well his focus on the Café Concert. So I wanted to end here, and thank you all for coming to hear this talk. Thank you. Thanks so much for coming.